This is Miss Calabro, and I got home thinking about the day on Wednesday and how busy it will be to get a lot of this talked about. And then I also realized that we have to go again to that job fair, which we'll lose about 45 minutes of time. So, in trying to save you some time of staying on Wednesday, I know some of you need to practice. I wanted to maybe do a little podcast, kind of introduce this material, especially the beginning, which kind of goes over the cardiac history, some of the indicators that we look for with pediatrics and dysfunction with the cardiac system. Of course, fetal circulation, all of that's got to be reviewed in your mind in order to understand the congenital heart defects. If I get a chance in this lecture or in this podcast, I will talk about heart failure and some of the signs and symptoms with that. And I know you've had that. We'll talk about right-sided and left-sided, and I know you've had a lot of that with the adult fundamental class. So anyway, I know to get started, I wanted to talk about the cardiac. Your first slide ask some questions, and in reference to congenital heart disease, you really need to know, once again, some of your anatomy and physiology. Can you trace a drop of blood through the heart, where it goes? Do you understand where the flow and the pressure gradients are? That's important to where high pressure and low pressure, and of course, a flow, goes from high pressure to low pressure. So, with pressure gradients, that matters. Do you know normal fetal circulation and, of course, the shunting that happens with fetal circulation? Sometimes with cardiac disease or congenital heart defects, some of those shunts or fetal openings in the heart may remain open so that that baby can have blood circulation. Once again, variations between the systemic and the vascular resistance, that's important to understand. And then, of course, the term cyanotic and acyanotic. You can have congenital heart defects in which the baby or the child presents with cyanosis, or deoxygenated blood is circulated throughout the system, causing cyanosis, as far as a change in their color. And then some heart defects, you have a mixing of deoxygenated and oxygenated blood, so you may not see cyanosis. There are two processes, really more than that, that we'll talk about when I begin this lecture on Wednesday about heart defects. But because of the increased pulmonary blood flow, that would be a left to right shunt. So if you have left ventricle or left atrium that is shunting blood, maybe there's a hole in the septum there. Some of you have done the atrial septal defect, and then some have done the ventricular septal defect. And of course, that's just a hole in that wall that separates the two chambers, whether it be the atria or the ventricles. And when you have that, you have a high pressure with the left atrium and the left ventricle, so it flows blood into the right. And of course, that would increase blood flow because from the right atrium to the left to the right ventricle, it goes through the pulmonary artery to the lungs. So therefore, you have an increased pulmonary blood flow that go into the lungs. So with some heart defects, you'll have that. And usually you don't have cyanosis with that, but we'll talk later about that. Decreased blood flow, pulmonary blood flow. There are situations where you have a decrease in the pulmonary blood flow. So you can imagine with these babies, sometimes there is cyanosis because there's not that gas exchange happening in the pulmonary vascular bed. Inadequate tissue oxygenation, of course, that happens with that, and that's that right, it can be right to left shunting. The next slide talks about cardiac structure and function. Remember the fetal circulation, the umbilical vein, and the umbilical arteries. Of course, blood with the oxygen and nutrition travels from the placenta through the umbilical vein to the baby. And of course, the blood is returned from the baby to the placenta to be oxygenated there, and nutritional value there is exchanged by the two arteries. So remember, there's two arteries and one vein, and the vein goes, and it's kind of backwards because we're used to veins carrying deoxygenated blood back to the heart. But of course, here the umbilical vein carries the blood to the baby that's oxygenated, and it's half of it goes to the liver to keep the liver well perfused, and then the other half travels directly to the inferior vena cava up to the right, you know, of course, that inferior vena cava travels to the right atrium. The superior vena cava in the baby, of course, collects and supplies blood from the head and the upper extremities. Blood that is there goes through the superior vena cava into the right atrium. This blood is shunted through, remember, a foramen ovale to the left atrium. So there is this blood. Remember, with the baby, the lungs are pretty non-essential and non-functioning, so there's no gas exchange or exchange of CO2 and O2 in the lungs here. So a lot of times that foramen ovale is open, so the blood flows from that right atrium to the left atrium. Some blood does go through to the right ventricle and to the lungs, but once again, that's a really small amount, and that's blood goes to the non-functional lungs by the way of the pulmonary artery. Oxygenated blood then goes from the left atrium. Now, this is all oxygenated blood. Remember, with the fetal circulation, all the oxygenation and the gas exchange happens with the placenta. So blood going to the lungs from the right ventricle. Blood that goes from the left atrium to the left ventricle, and then it goes out to the aorta. That blood that does go to the lungs from the right ventricle is shunted oftentimes to the descending aorta through that patent ductus arteriosus. So it really doesn't ever go to the lungs. From the pulmonary artery, you've got this shunt, this patent ductus arteriosus that is open and supplies blood to that descending aorta. So you've got blood going from your left ventricle to your aorta, and then you've got this shunt from the pulmonary artery called the patent ductus arteriosus. That ductus venosus that's on your slide connects the umbilical vein to the inferior vena cava. And you probably don't remember this, but when they're born, that actually deteriorates and kind of atrophies and goes away, becomes a ligament, to be honest. Fetal circulation, again, this the structural changes that ensures that the most vital organs and tissues receive the maximum concentration of oxygenated blood within this fetal circulation. Once again, all that oxygen's coming from the placenta, travels to all the vital organs, and because it doesn't have to go to the lungs, it does oxygenate the tissue well with the maximum concentration of oxygenated blood. The fetal brain requires the highest oxygen concentration. And then the lungs are, once again, essentially non-functional, and the liver is only partially functional, and it does receive oxygenated blood as well. Less blood is needed in these organs in fetal life, but of course that changes when birth happens. Here again is a picture of your fetal circulation on the left, and then of course the normal circulation or postnatal circulation on your right. If you notice, the blood travels from the inferior vena cava, the head and the upper extremities of the baby, into the right atrium, and then of course from the inferior vena cava, that ductus venosus is that connection to the umbilical vein. So you've got your oxygenated blood coming up to the through the inferior vena cava as well. It mixes in the right atrium, and then there's a hole there from the foramen ovale. Blood travels from the right atrium to the left, from the right atrium to the left atrium. From the left atrium, it goes to the left ventricle. And then, of course, it goes out the pulmonary veins and out to the aorta, actually. You've got the pulmonary veins that are going from the lungs back to the left atrium. But from the left ventricle, you've got blood going through the aorta. And, of course, there's a connection here. You can see on your picture from the pulmonary artery, there's a shunt there that also delivers blood from your right ventricle going to those pulmonary artery. It goes through that ductus arteriosus and goes down the descending aorta. So you've got blood coming to the aorta from your left ventricle and also from that ductus arteriosus connection. Now, however, with the postnatal circulation, you look on the right, and that ductus venosus, once again, becomes a ligament. It kind of, atrophies and goes away. Your inferior vena cava, and, of course, your superior vena cava now has deoxygenated blood, and that blood travels from your right atrium to your right ventricle through your pulmonary artery to your lungs, where it's oxygenated, and then your pulmonary veins, brings that oxygenated blood back to the left atrium through the left ventricle, and then, of course, through your aorta and descending aorta, and then, of course, your subclavian arteries, and up to circulate and perfuse your head and your upper extremities. And of course, at the time of birth, there's hours afterwards, that patent ductus arteriosus should close on its own. Now, there will be some defects we talk about that we want to keep that open because there is poor oxygenation. The pulmonary, of course, with birth, the pulmonary vascular resistance causes that increase in pressure too with the right side of the heart. After birth, blood goes to the lungs and pressures in that right side, of course, the heart decreases. So pre-birth or prenatal circulation, you have a really high pressure in the right atrium, and that's what causes that blood to flow to the left atrium. Remember, with your pressure gradients, it goes from a high pressure to low pressure. With that pulmonary, that also causes pulmonary, the pressure, high pressure in that right atrium is also caused by the high pulmonary resistance, that vascular resistance. You know, they the right ventricle, if you have a ventricular septal defect, it's always going to go from the right ventricle to the left ventricle in prenatal circulation as well. Postnatal circulation, once again, is different. Your vascular resistance increases, and also your pressure in that right side of your heart decreases. So with the pressure increasing on the left side of your heart, that's what pumps the blood out to the aorta. And of course, you've got that vascular the vascular circulatory resistance that goes up too. The pediatric indicators of cardiac dysfunction. Your book talks about an assessment of cardiac function with these children. If a child shows with cardiac dysfunction, you're usually going to see signs and symptoms of hypoxia. Remember your Maslow's hierarchy and how important oxygen is as far as your bodily functions. With hypoxia, we'll see sometimes babies that are poor eaters. They have a hard time, of course, you know, consumption of O2. And then, of course, the low levels of oxygen concentration in the circulatory system. And then in the tissues, hypoxemia, we're going to talk about that. But hypoxia being your, you know, low levels of oxygen in the blood causes the babies to not eat well, to not grow well, and then not develop well. Important to other signs and symptoms they present with, of course, is your tachypnea, sweating, pallor, you know, tachycardia. These are common with heart defects. We see babies with cardiac dysfunction and congenital heart defects. You may see older kids that develop cardiomyopathy. So any kind of cardiac dysfunction, these kids can look like this. The babies that have a hard time growing look and appear as failure to thrive in the office. Of course, they have poor weight gain. They fall less than that 5% on the growth chart. And they have great activity intolerance. And that can be with the older kids, too, with exercise tolerance. We ask them in their history, how well do they tolerate, you know, mild exercise, moderate exercise, and sports. With the older kids, you may see edema and respiratory issues, chest pain they might complain of, and even have some fainting or headaches. Developmental delays, that can be common oftentimes with babies of congenital heart defects. They're because of their growth and their development lags behind too. Prenatal history, we are going to ask about the mother's history and their pregnancy with this baby. Oftentimes babies have higher risk of cardiac dysfunction and congenital heart defects if they've been born preterm. I've also talked about the other congenital anomalies that that can be associated with cardiac or heart defects. IUGR, the smaller babies, the intrauterine growth retardation, those babies are more likely to have congenital anomalies in the general population. If the mother has had alcohol use or drug abuse, that can put a baby at risk for cardiac dysfunction and congenital heart defects. Exposure to infection, rubella. We talked about rubella and infection with the mom and how the fetus is negatively affected. And this is one of those times where it could be that their heart is affected. And then macrosomic babies, the big babies of your diabetic mothers, they have a high risk of cardiac dysfunction. with the family history of cardiac disease, the, you know, if they've had frequent fetal loss, that was another, you know, reason to ask the mom about her prenatal history if she's lost a lot of babies. If the family's had sudden infant deaths with babies, that could be a sign of cardiac dysfunction. There's an increased risk. I talked about with Down syndrome and Turner syndrome earlier today, have an increased risk with blood disorders and things like that. But once again, they have also, if there's a family history of sudden death in the adults or heart disease with the adults, it could be that the children are at risk for that. If there's history of congenital heart defects in the parents or the siblings, that puts them at the baby at great risk as well. With older kids too, you want to ask about recent infections or toxic exposures that may precede the development of heart diseases. We talked about rheumatic fever and that being a consequence of infection with the older kids. Look for other congenital anomalies I mentioned, and then also ask the mother about any medications that she took that could have had a negative effect on the development of their heart. So, of course, all these babies, all this, you know, the prenatal history that we talked about, the family history, that all puts these kids at risk. Their physical exam, there's a variety of invasive and non-invasive tests that can be used to diagnose children with heart disease. Of course, chest X-ray is the most frequent ordered test for children with suspected cardiac problems. It shows the size of the heart and configuration and pattern of blood flow with the heart. I was thinking about diagnostic testing. Let me talk again. Sorry, go back to physical examination with these kids. What do these kids look like? Well, of course, their vital signs are their heart rate may be abnormally fast with tachycardia or abnormally slow with bradycardia. A fast respiratory rate can also indicate heart failure. We'll talk about some of the signs of heart failure. So you do want to look at their heart rate, their respiratory rate with their vital signs. Hypertension, of course, blood pressure is diagnosed by having many blood pressure measurements. You just can't have one measurement and deem a child as hypertensive. Same with adults. It has to be a diagnosis over several measurements. The differences, there are differences between the upper and lower extremity. If that happens, this may signify a baby that's got a coarctation of the aorta. We'll talk about that with the heart defect, but the coarctation of the aorta is basically where the aorta is stenosed so badly that there's a blockage of blood flow there. So it really creates a higher blood pressure in your upper extremities. A lower blood pressure in your upper extremities, and there may be a higher blood pressure in your lower extremities. Anyway, there's a big difference in a blood pressure. If you take it on a baby that's got a coarctation, you always see a big difference with the pressure taken in their arm versus taken in their leg. And I know in the nursery, the doctor that we had at Delta Regional wanted us to take blood pressures. If there was any suspicious history with the patient, we would take blood pressures in the arm and in the leg with the babies. We do an assessment, of course, of their pulses. Listening for murmurs, there may be, because of that vibration over the heart, you may even feel a thrill with the heart and the blood flow that's abnormal. But you may also hear murmurs. Those are heart sounds that reflect the flow of the blood through the heart, within the heart. And, of course, differences with that blood flow, whether it be through a foramen ovale or patent ductus or any kind of septal defects, you may hear murmurs. Assess the quality and symmetry of all the pulses, the warmth of the extremities, presence of edema, determining the PMI and the apical impulse. That tells you the position of the heart. So that would be important when you're auscultating the heart sounds to see where you hear that. I do have a note that 80% of children have an innocent murmur of one type during childhood. So just because they have a murmur doesn't always mean that they have a heart disease or a heart problem, but it bears watching. With babies, especially in the first week, oftentimes murmurs are misinterpreted as a negative sound, but it may be that the patent ducted arteriosus hasn't closed yet, so you may hear a little bit of a different heart sound with those babies. Now, the test of cardiac function, as I was saying, a lot of invasive and non-invasive tests are done. There's a table in your book on page 1256 that goes over all these tests of cardiac function. The chest x-ray, as I had said, was the most frequent ordered test for children with suspected cardiac problems. It shows that size of the heart and configuration, pattern of blood flow. The EKG, that measures, of course, your electrical activity of the heart. Bedside monitoring of the heart is commonly used in the care of children with heart disease. If they are in the hospital or in the clinic, they usually will run a EKG. Of course, on the EKG, they can see the rhythm and the conduction, but also the heart rate, any abnormalities, if there's been any damage, if there's electrolyte imbalances, effects of certain drugs. You can see all those with an EKG. An echocardiograph. Of course, echocardiogram, that's most frequently used to detect cardiac dysfunction in children. It confirms the diagnosis of many congenital heart defects without resorting to a cardiac cath. Some kids might need a mild sedative in order to sit there and be still for that echo. Your book talked about a transesophageal echo, sometime that being used, but I don't go into a great detail with that. I do talk about the pre-procedural things that we do before a cardiac cath with kids and after, and we'll get to that. Of course, your cardiac cath is your most invasive, and that uses contrast, usually the catheter inserted through a peripheral blood vessel, usually through your femoral vein, and that's usually combined with angiograph so that you can see where that contrast and where the blood flow at that heart, if there's any blockages and where the blood flow goes. If there's shunting, then you would see that in the cardiac cath. But most of the time, you can see it on an echo. So very seldom do we have to go and do cardiac caths, but sometimes they are ordered for the baby. There's also MRIs of the cardiac system in the heart to visualize structures that you can't really see on an echo. Sometimes that MRI is ordered. The interventional, the cardiac cath, of course, that procedure is just like you would with adults. They use a balloon to dilate narrowing of the valves and the vessels. The catheter can deliver devices to close up some of the defects that we have. Of course, the cardiac cath provides information regarding oxygen saturation, pressure changes, cardiac output, stroke volume, and any kind of anatomic abnormalities. Transposition of the great vessels, that oftentimes is seen and diagnosed when a child goes into a cardiac cath. Some of your single ventricle defects, your ASD, of course, all of those, pulmonary artery stenosis. Some of these can be corrected with interventional cardiac cath procedures. Some of these procedures that fix some of these heart defects here, once again, it can be done. That reduces surgical treatment. They don't have to go to surgery for some of these congenital defects, such as these, that can be corrected by. With ASD, of course, with that, they would put a some kind of device to cover that blockage or to cover that hole in order to make that septum connected and whole. Some PDAs, if they need to be open, we have to put in a little balloon, not a stent, but a balloon to dilate that and keep it open. Once again, some ventricle defects, atrial septal defects, and then the pulmonary artery stenosis, that is another way or another situation where interventional cardiac procedures can be done in the cardiac cath lab, such as the balloon to dilate those vessels and valves. And this is what I was talking about just right here with the valve, the pulmonic stenosis, coarctation of the aorta. And lots of times, once again, that intervention with the balloon dilation can be done in the cardiac cath lab with the kids. I've got a picture of the cardiac cath table here. Nursing care with pre-procedural care with the assessment of the babies and the kids. Of course, you want to complete a nursing assessment with height and weight, allergies. Oftentimes, that contrast has iodine in it, so you need to know if they're allergic to anything. Their pulses. Pulses are a big deal, of course, just like with your adults. Checking those, having a baseline assessment of your pulses and assess them. And sometimes they mark them so that we go to that same spot to assess them on post-procedure. And we get a baseline oxygen saturation in those kids with cyanosis. So kind of we know what their baseline is. Prepare this child for this procedure based on their developmental level. You might use a doll, you might use posters or any kind of, just depends on what their developmental level, what their learning level is. Of course, all the teaching and the preparation is geared toward that. Include the caregivers, of course, as much as you can in the pre-procedural, and then also post-procedural care. They can be included and they know what, are taught what to do. Sedation may be given. It may be Demerol and Versed given to these kids. Chlorhydrate may be given. It can be oral or IV. They're usually MPO, including their meds that of course, before the procedure. If it's a medication that they question, they can ask the doctor if that child can get that medication before, even though they're MPO. But most meds, as the slide says, most AM meds are withheld. Of course, post-procedural recovery, you know, with recovery in a unit or in the hospital room with the kids, you would always monitor for complications such as acute bleeding from that site where they went in. We've got the kid usually on a cardiac monitor and a pulse ox, of course, measuring oxygenation saturations compared to what their baseline. We assess and they're monitoring their pulses, their temperature. Once again, for equality, symmetry, make sure they're as strong as they were and that they need to be. Their color and their temp, that also tells you a lot about perfusion. Vital signs every 15 minutes. Now, that's usually protocol for so many, you know, an hour or so many times you do it every 15 minutes times four, and then you do it every 30 minutes times two. It kind of like blood administration. It has a protocol to check your vital signs post-catheterization with close eye on their blood pressure, and heart rate is important too to take. Their dressing in their femoral area, you want to make sure that's intact and there's no bleeding. A lot of times we're seeing these foam dressings that are on there, or little plugs that might even be placed that are dissolvable, but they provide that direct pressure for any kind of bleeding from that site. A hematoma sometimes in that femoral or antecubital area where you entered can also be present. Their fluid intake, eyes and nose, is important with the after a cath. You've got that contrast dye, so you want to make sure the contrast that you've used. So oftentimes that's how they're excreted it through their urine. So you want to make sure you give them adequate fluid intake and make sure hydration is good so they can help get rid of that contrast. Monitor for low-grade fever, nausea, vomiting. Of course, a loss of a pulse in the catheterized in that extremity that you went in, that would be an immediate need to call the provider and to let them know. Hematomas can also, like I said, develop right there. Monitor for hypoglycemia, especially with your infants. If they've been MPO, you know, you may even have to give them some dextrose in their IV fluids. And then, of course, blood glucose. They might even have to check that if that gets too low. Depending on the hospital policy, a child can remain in the bed for 4 to 6 hours with that affected extremity straight, just kind of like you would with adults. Their diet can be resumed once they, you know, kind of get more awake and they're less nauseated. Tylenol, ibuprofen can be given for pain. Tell the parents to observe that site once they leave for redness, swelling, drainage, any kind of bleeding or oozing from that site. Avoid tub baths for the first 3 days after a cardiac cath, and of course any strenuous exercise. They can go to school, but they don't need to be, you know, in physical activity or strenuous activity. With two types of cardiac defects, we refer to a defect in the heart or great vessels as that defect that persists. Sometimes it's a persistence of a fetal structure after they're born, and sometimes it's an actual defect in that heart or the great vessels. Congenital, meaning they're born at birth, a lot of times, more than any, is anatomic or the anatomy is not right, and that causes the dysfunction and the abnormal function with the heart. And acquired, you can have heart defects or disease processes that are acquired. As children, a lot of times, once again, it can be infection, an autoimmune response, environmental factors, and familial tendencies that predispose the kids. So it may be that their heart is normal. There's no abnormalities with the birth or in development of the heart, but after they're born, they can acquire cardiac dysfunction. the causes of congenital heart disease or congenital heart defects. Your book says a lot of times if we talk about maternal or environmental causes, we really don't know why congenital heart defects. The exact cause is unknown, but most result as a interaction of genetic and environmental influences with maternal drug use. Like I said, with fetal alcohol syndrome, 50% of those kids have some kind of congenital heart defect. They also have other kind of syndromes as well. A lot of times with maternal illnesses, I talked about the rubella infection in that first 7 weeks of pregnancy. If a mother gets a rubella infection, they can have a 50% risk of having defects, including a patent ductus arteriosus and then a pulmonary stenosis. CMV is your cytomegalovirus and toxoplasmosis. Other viral illnesses can cause cardiac defects with the maternal with the maternity or the maternal woman. And then, of course, I said a little bit about the diabetic mothers, the insulin-dependent diabetics, with the pregnancy of those mothers, that 10% risk of congenital heart defect. And I have listed what some of those most commonly are. Not only with environmental, you know, once again, it can be a lot of these maternal risk factors, and environmental. Advanced maternal age is another risk factor with congenital heart defects, not as so much as the other ones that are listed. And then, of course, a family history of a cardiac defect, as I said earlier, in a parent or a sibling, increases the likelihood. Here again, it's often that genetic and chromosomal abnormalities, if you've got another chromosomal abnormality, you have a 10 to 12% chance of having a congenital heart defect as well. Specific syndromes, I talked about Down syndrome and Turner syndrome. Those babies oftentimes have to be followed closely by cardiology, because there is an increased risk with cardiac dysfunction with those kids. Another anomalies, I talked about TEF earlier, diaphragmatic hernia, renal abnormalities. Those babies oftentimes will also have an increased risk for congenital heart defects if they have those other things, other anomalies. Multifactorial, of course, 85% of the risk is because it's combined. It's genetics, environment. So 85% of the time, it's a combination of both genetics and environment. The next slide comes from your book. Of course, it talks about the incidence of congenital heart defects with babies, 5 to 8 per 1,000 live births. Two or three out of this 5 or 8 are symptomatic in the first year of life. So that leaves you to know that a lot of the babies that have congenital heart defects, they don't become symptomatic until after that first year. But 2 to 3 of them, so, you know, almost a majority, almost half of those babies show some kind of signs or symptoms in that first year of life. I mean, it depends on what kind of defect it is. This is a major cause of death in that first year of life, after prematurity. Prematurity is that number one cause of death in that first year of life, but the second one is some kind of congenital heart defect. Sometimes the babies go immediately to surgery, and sometimes we can wait. Here again on your slide, 28% of children with congenital heart defect have another anomaly, and I talked about the trisomy, the chromosomal abnormalities, and some of the other anomalies that we talked about. 40,000 infants expected to be affected each year by congenital heart defects. Of these, about 25% require some kind of invasive treatment in that first year of life. Once again, you know, half of them show symptoms in that first year of life. Now, it's all about the hemodynamics. You know, you got to know, once again, how pressure gradients and flow, and then, of course, resistance within the circulation work in order to understand some of these heart defects. So I have a slide here that kind of talks a little bit about, helps you to understand that. Blood flows because of pressure gradients in different parts of the body, and the heart's pumping. Blood flows from an area of high pressure to an area of low pressure, we just talked about. So with the fetal circulation, the high pressure in the right side of the heart, that means that the right atrium blood flows through that foramen ovale to the left atrium because of the pressure gradient. Now when, you know, of course, the postnatal circulation, that changes. Rate of flow is directly proportional to the resistant. That, you know, flow always takes the path of least resistance. So if there's less resistance, that's where it's going to flow. And that has a lot to do with your vascular systemic resistance. If it's high, then you have a hard time with the flow of blood through that. So once again, with high blood pressure, we have a high blood pressure because there is that increased pressure in trying to push blood through maybe a narrowed artery or a narrowed vein. Normally, pressure on the right side of the heart is lower than the left. However, the resistance in the pulmonary circulation is less than the systemic. So once again, low pressure in the pulmonary artery, high in the aorta, that is normal. That is the normal way. Now, what we're going to see with some of these defects is that's not true, or that doesn't happen. So that's some of the reasons we see the symptoms that we see and also see heart failure. Here's a great slide. It's wonderful because it shows, it tells you about left to right shunt, right to left shunt. It is a great slide because it also incorporates some of that pressure gradients and why it flows the way it does. Shunt movement of blood between the heart chambers and an abnormal opening. So if you have a hole within the septum, this is explaining the left to right shunt. So if you have movement of blood from the left, which is normally a higher pressure than the right side. Remember, this is after birth. This is not fetal circulation. So after birth, you should have that higher pressure in the left side and then going to the right side of the heart. So if you've got, oxygenated blood, of course, coming from the lungs to that left atrium or that left ventricle, if it goes to the right side, then you have oxygenated blood that mixes with unoxygenated blood, and it returns to the lungs through that right ventricle. Oftentimes, these kids do not have cyanosis because if you think about it, oxygenated blood is still going through that left atrium, left ventricle, through the aorta to the body. But some of that, because of a septal defect of some sort or some heart defect, blood is also through an abnormal opening going to the right side of the heart. Now, right to left shunt. However, this is movement of blood from the right side of the heart to the left side through an abnormal opening. So you think about that foramen ovale being open or some kind of atrial septal defect. You've got a hole there in that septum, in that wall. So you have movement of blood from the right side of the heart to the left side through that abnormal opening. Oftentimes, this results from a severe obstruction to the pulmonary blood flow, and once again, blood shunts from the right side to the left side. Now, because it does not go to the lungs, if you have a high resistance in the pulmonary blood flow, meaning the pulmonary artery, maybe you have stenosis with the pulmonary artery, then not as much blood is going to the lungs to be oxygenated, and therefore you may have this shunting of the right to the left. So what we are seeing is unoxygenated blood that has not gone to the lungs yet, going to the left atrium, going to the left ventricle, and then out the aorta into the body. So here you do have unoxygenated blood that mixes with oxygenated blood and circulates out to the body. So when you don't, when you have that mixture going out to the body, then you have cyanosis. It can be, present. The picture I showed you here has just got pressure gradients and showing you what it should look like after birth. And it shows that a greater pressure in the left atrium than the right atrium, and then, of course, a greater pressure in the left ventricle. The pressure here in the left atrium and left ventricle is huge. It can be 5 to 10 versus the 3 that's in the right atrium. And then you've got 120 millimeter of pressure in the left ventricle versus the right ventricle at 25. So, you got a lot of differences with the pressure gradients there, and that's all that picture's really showing. And then, of course, with your aorta, you've got, a lot of pressure. You've got oxygenated blood. Once again, you've got deoxygenated blood in that right atrium and right ventricle going to your lungs by way of the pulmonary artery. When it comes from the veins, pulmonary veins from the lungs to the left atrium, you've got high oxygenated blood traveling to the body, unless you've got a cardiac defect. With oxygen saturation, the blood returning to the heart via the superior vena cava and inferior vena cava should have the lowest oxygen saturations, of course. Blood returning from the lungs to the heart via the pulmonary veins should be fully saturated. So thinking about that, you have to understand with the mixing of the blood, and of course, we'll talk about that. preductal and postductal oxygen saturation monitoring. I don't really want to talk a lot about that, except some of this blood returning to the heart, like I just said, had the via the blood returning to the heart has the lowest oxygen saturation, and then of course from the lungs to the heart, with the pulmonary veins, should be fully saturated. So depending on the defect, that saturated blood and desaturated blood may mix. Once again, it may be that you have enough oxygenated blood that cyanosis is not present. There are situations and defects where, you know, there is not oxygenation hardly at all, and those are those cyanotic heart defects that we'll talk about, or that cause cyanosis. The amount of mixed blood reaching the systemic circulation, like I said, displays varying degrees of hypoxemia, which is your oxygen, low oxygen in the tissues, which presents itself as cyanosis. Clinical consequences of congenital heart defect, of course, depending on the severity of the heart defect and the altered hemodynamics, you have two clinical consequences with congenital heart defects. And it all depends on the severity of that defect and then the hemodynamics, the way blood is flowing, and also with deoxygenated and oxygenated blood. You could have heart failure with these kids, and then, of course, hypoxemia, which we'll talk about both of these in detail. Defects with your left to right shunting, you know, oftentimes causes signs and symptoms of heart failure. Defects resulting in decreased pulmonary blood flow causes cyanosis. If you think about defects that are causing a decreased blood flow going to the lungs, then you have less oxygenation happening, right? So you've got deoxygenated blood that continually circulates through the system. And those are those patients and those babies that present with cyanosis and hypoxemia with the tissues. This can occur, you know, heart failure and hypoxemia can occur alone, or it can, you know, occur together and concurrently. All right, so one of those consequences of congenital heart defects is heart failure in children. Oftentimes, just like with adults, you know, heart failure, the definition is the inability of the heart to pump an adequate amount of blood to the systemic circulation at normal pressures to meet the body's metabolic demands. Reviewing with preload and afterload, of course, remembering preload is the volume of blood that returns to the heart, or the circulating blood volume, and the afterload, of course, is the resistance against which the ventricles must pump when ejecting the blood. With heart failure, we look at these four things. Volume overload, especially with your left to right shunts, that may cause the right ventricle to hypertrophy. If it's got more blood volume there, then it may hypertrophy. It takes more muscle and more contractibility to push it to where it needs to go. So to compensate for that additional blood volume, the muscle there and that right atrium may overgrow or hypertrophy. So oftentimes with the volume overload that it suffers, you have hypertrophy of your right atrium. Of course, with heart failure, we call that right-sided heart failure, and we know some of the signs and symptoms we'll go over. Pressure overload, it's on your slide. That primarily results from any obstructive lesions, stenosis, coarctation of the aorta. Once again, the pressure overload in the heart, if it's having a hard time pushing against something and pushing blood through, if it's obstructed, if that blood flow is obstructed by anything, of course, that causes a high pressure gradient behind that. So the pressure overload in the heart due to some of these defects can cause heart failure with the kids. Decreased contractility of the myocardium, that of course of the heart muscle, that's affected, and especially the older kids affected by cardiomyopathy or ischemia. Your severe anemia, you think about what we just talked about today with anemia. You have a decreased red blood cell, you have decreased hemoglobin and oxygen carrying capability. So with that, you may have heart damage and ischemia even in the organ of your heart. Heart blocks, acidemia, low levels of potassium, glucose, calcium, magnesium, all those electrolytes that are necessary for the function of your heart. If those are in low levels, then you may have a decrease in the contractility of their heart. And of course, there's drugs that we give for those patients that have that. Kids that have cardiomyopathy, sometimes we don't know until they have a sudden arrest. These, athletes that are, dying on the heart, dying on the basketball court or in the football field or baseball field, oftentimes it's related to a cardiomyopathy that they have or that is discovered. And, of course, it can be traced back to sometimes the heart not being able to contract like it should because of the disease of the heart. With high cardiac output demands, that's the body's need for oxygenated blood exceeds the heart's cardiac output. That can cause heart failure in children. Even though the volume may be normal, the body needs more oxygenated blood, and that needs exceeds the cardiac output of the heart. Sepsis is a situation where you have, a high demand for oxygenated blood. Hyperthyroidism is another. Severe anemia is another, where the cardiac output is not enough to supply the body with oxygenated blood. The etiology, or the cause of heart failure in children, on your slide there, box 29-2 on 1230, it's 1263, not 1236. That is page 1263 that has this information. In children with heart failure or congestive heart failure, that occurs more frequently secondary to congenital heart defects. Because of those four things we talked about with volume overload, contractility problem, pressure overload, those are sometimes related to your septal defects, obstruction to your left ventricle outflow, which is narrowing of the aorta, that coarctation of the aorta. Some of you did that congenital heart defect. Of course, anything that causes more pressure with the heart or volume overload with the heart, that heart failure oftentimes is a result or secondary to that heart defect. Diseases in other organ systems, particularly the lungs, can also cause heart failure with children. Anything that increases the volume load or increases the pressure load on those ventricles and aorta. Heart failure can also be the result of excessive workload on the normal heart muscle. Once again, because of cardiomyopathy, any kind of drug use, electrolyte imbalances I'm thinking about the kids, not necessarily with a congenital heart defect, but with kids with cardiomyopathy, of course, heart failure can occur. With heart failure, just like with some of the adults, heart failure can be divided up into two types, your right-sided failure, which is your, and your left-sided failure. Each type produces different signs and symptoms, as y'all know, but clinically with kids, it's unusual to observe slowly just the right-side or left-sided failure signs. So another reason why kids are a little bit different, a little bit harder to assess, sometimes they don't present with just right-sided failure signs and left-sided failure signs. But I do have them here on your slide. Right-sided failure, of course, that's a reduced function. It's caused by a reduced function of your right ventricle, usually. Your right atrium and your right ventricle results when the right ventricle end diastolic pressure rises. That increases central venous pressure. And then, of course, systemic venous engorgement happens. So the way I see it is that there's a lot of pressure and a lot of overwork with that right ventricle to push blood to the lungs. And of course, when that doesn't happen, your venous system, with the hypertension that happens because of that, you have a lot of back congestion, I guess. It can cause hematomegaly and then also edema in your extremities with the backup and the congestion within the venous system. With the left-sided failure, of course, that's oftentimes increased pressure. If you have your left side heart, that is oftentimes increased pressure with that left ventricle dysfunction. As that increase in pressure in the left atrium happens, you also then have pressure that is high in your pulmonary veins, which causes congestion in the lungs with blood because of that pressure gradient and the pressure that it takes to push against that high pressure that's in your left ventricle, left atrium. It causes elevated pulmonary pressures and the lungs become congested. So oftentimes that's why with left-sided failure you hear, you have symptoms within the lungs. You have a lot of pulmonary edema and the consequences of that. This slide comes straightly from your book. There's compensatory mechanisms that happen with the sympathetic nervous system. With heart failure, of course, it makes the heart rate increase and the force of contraction hopefully increases. That's where we see tachycardia as the result of that. Stimulation of the cholinergic fibers makes these kids sweat. So a lot of times with heart failure, these kids, even at rest, will have tachycardia, tachypnea, and they'll be sweating. Hypertrophy and dilation as a result of that increased volume and pressure. Resistance, of course, that happens with the hypertrophy I told you about, especially with the right side. But the left side, too, can hypertrophy because of that increase in volume or the increase in pressure. Stimulation, I said, of the sympathetic nervous system, that increased heart rate. Of course, it releases catecholamines, and that increases the rate of contraction and the force of contraction. With your renal system, that's on here, too. It decreases the blood flow to your kidneys, which just sets off a production of renin, aldosterone, ADH. Of course, that creates sodium and water retention, and that's why you oftentimes have potassium that's increased a lot, but your systemic and your pulmonary venous engorgement with edema, that's where we see that within the system with extremities and also with your pulmonary system. Clinical signs and manifestations. If these compensatory mechanisms are exceeded and they can't work, children will start to exhibit some of these signs of heart failure due to that decreased myocardial impaired in function, due to pulmonary congestion, and due to systemic venous congestion. So these clinical manifestations are all underneath these three major signs of heart failure and what they're related to. One of the earliest signs is, of course, an increased heart rate. I talked about the compensatory mechanism being that increase, that catecholamine release, and, of course, sympathetic nervous system. The kids will show with impaired myocardial function, tachycardia, sweating, fatigue, weakness, restlessness. Sometimes they're pallor. Of course, pallor is an ominous sign, but they decrease their urine output, decrease their heart cardiac output related to that, decrease their blood pressure, cool extremities, their decreased urine output, as I said, and weak pulses. So when you have impaired myocardial function, normally it's not pumping as hard as it should. So these are all things that exhibit as far as clinical manifestations. Pulmonary congestion, of course, with left-sided heart failure, oftentimes tachypnea can lead to hypoxemia because the oxygen doesn't reach the alveoli with a faster rate. So oftentimes, even though you're breathing fast, these kids don't have the gas exchange that's necessary. So you may see other things, tachypnea once again being the big one, in response to the decreased lung compliance. Of course, with congestion in their lungs, there's the ability to expand is harder, so therefore they're going to try harder. Respiratory distress, wheezing, grunting, all of these things are going to happen with pulmonary congestion related to heart failure. Retractions are even seen at rest sometimes with the infants and heart failure. The systemic venous congestion, of course, this is where you see your peripheral and periorbital edema, the weight gain, ascites, hepatomegaly, the neck vein distension, even with children, you might see those, with especially the older children, not the infants. The infants have short necks. You really can't see any kind of distension with their neck veins with babies, but you will see with the older kids, just like with you do with adults. Diagnosis is based on these clinical findings, and of course we also will look at x-rays and EKGs and echoes, as I talked about earlier, diagnostically. Management of the heart failure with these goals with kids, you want to, of course, improve their cardiac function. I think the next slide goes over some of the drugs that we give. Of course, we want to increase the contractility and decrease the workload with the heart. So there's ways and there's things that we do that with decreased preload. That basically the Goal here is to remove any kind of accumulated fluid and sodium. I have sodium on there twice. I only mean to have it once. Removing that accumulated fluid and sodium, of course, we use diuretics with adults, and we also use that with children to do to perform that goal. Decrease their cardiac demands. Of course, I'm going to talk about ways that we do that with the kids. Improving their tissue oxygenation, and of course, decreasing their oxygen consumption. These are all management goals with heart failure. Now, these slides tell you a little bit of how we're going to do this. Drugs that enhance myocardial performance, of course, digitalis, that's the big one that we know about and that you already know about. That's almost used exclusively because of its rapid onset of action and decreased risk of toxicity. It does improve contractility with the heart. So these kids with heart failure, if they're exhibiting signs of heart failure, and it's related, of course, to any kind of... And once again, remember, most of these kids with heart failure, they're diagnosed because they've got a congenital... with heart failure because they've had a congenital heart defect to cause this. It may go undetected until you do see the signs of heart failure. Infants with heart failure, oftentimes, once again, if it's found right away, a congenital heart defect, hopefully they'll be stabilized and repaired with surgery so that they don't run the risk of having heart failure in the long run. All right, going back to the drugs that enhance myocardial performance, your DIG, we do give the Lanoxin PO. It is an elixir form is available with these kids, and we give 50 micrograms per milliliter. And of course, that's often it's all based on their weight as well. It increases that, once again, the force of contraction, decreases their heart rate, slows the conduction of impulses through the AV node, and indirectly enhances diuresis by increasing their renal perfusion. Those are all things that some of these drugs do. With the angiotensin, another drug that we give, angiotensin converting or ACE inhibitors, that reduces the afterload on the heart, so vasodilation results. Frequently used in children, we see the use of captopril used 3 times a day, enalapril used 2x a day, and the lisinopril daily. So physician, once again, oftentimes will use these drugs. With the digoxin, I need to go back up and talk about, as a rule, the drug in your book, it's talked about administered to the kids. As a rule, it's not given if the pulse is below 90 to 100 with infants. So if it's 90 to 110 beats per minute, if it's anything below that, we don't give it to the infants. And with young children, also, if it's below 70 beats per minute with older children. Your book didn't really talk about ages, and I think that physician is always usually specific to the heart rate with the parameters when given this drug. But we all know that with digoxin in adults, we normally don't give it less than 60. I just wanted y'all to realize because the heart rate's higher with kids, the parameters on that's a little bit higher. All right, angiotensin converting enzymes, the ACE inhibitors, once again, reduce that afterload, causes vasodilation, which helps with that blood pressure that can sometimes be high, and that peripheral vascular resistance is high. So it also decreases the right atrium and the left atrium pressures, too, with vasodilation. So that's frequently used. Once again, that can be found in your book. Beta blockers are oftentimes used too, metoprolol and the Coreg. Those are the newest meds used for chronic heart failure with the kids. And your book talks a little bit about that too. That oftentimes will decrease heart rate if they're having the tachycardia that you see with heart failure. Removing their accumulated fluid and sodium with diuretics, the Lasix, of course, and the thiazides can cause a loss of potassium. This sometimes will mean that the kid needs to receive potassium supplements or dietary sources of potassium. We will sometimes fluid restrict these kids in acute phases or stages of heart failure. That may be done, but with kids, they become so easily dehydrated. Oftentimes, we don't restrict their fluid. And then sodium restriction, that's really less often used with kids as it was used a lot with adults, of course. There is a table 29.2 on page 1266 that talks about this too. The sodium restriction, oftentimes we don't do that because it has a negative effect on their appetite. All right, I've got about 30 seconds left in this. I'm going to stop here at decreased cardiac demands, and hopefully we'll have enough time to kind of go over this and talk about, I do want to talk about a care plan for the child with heart failure, so kind of be prepared to talk a little bit about that. Well, I got a little bit started, so that's good. I've got 1 hour behind, and we'll catch up and do the other on Wednesday. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.